Welcome to the Home Building Hero, where we help you become the hero of your new home by providing you all the information that you need. No matter if you're an industry pro, you're building, or you're buying, we got you covered here at the Home Building Hero. We're coming to you live today from the LP Studios here in Wisconsin. I'm your host, David Bellman, president of Bellman Homes. Thank you for tuning in today. Hey everyone, I'm here today with Jim Tobin, the CEO of the National Association of Home Builders. Hey Jim, welcome to the Home Building Hero.
Hey David, it's great to be on with you again. It's been I think it's maybe a couple of years ago we did something together, but it's great to be with you this morning. Thanks.
Absolutely. So thank you for being back on the show. And obviously some things have changed since the last time we've had you on. Why don't you first tell the audience a little bit more about who you are and yourself in the building industry?
Yeah, sure. Again, thanks for having me on. So I'm now in my 25th year at NHB. It came down, I'm originally from Connecticut, came down in 1995 to work for a member of Congress. And he promptly lost in 1996. Then I worked for another member of Congress who decided to retire in 1998. And I had it looking for a job every 2 years. So I had a friend over here at NHB and knew their reputation, knew that their values were aligned with my values, and decided to get into the association world and start my career as a lobbyist. And 25 years later, through the winding road of NHB, I find myself now CEO since June of last year. So it's been a great career. And as I tell people, you know, the housing industry is not a job for me. It's now is my career. I've dedicated my career to it. So it's very gratifying to still be part of, I think, the greatest industry in the country.
Well, first off, thank you for everything you're doing on behalf of the building industry. And then, of course, congrats on the new role. I know you don't want to be called the new guy anymore.
I know, right? Yeah.
Because you're not really the new guy. It's just a new position.
Yeah, as long as the new thing comes with the honeymoon phase, I'll go that forever. That's fine.
Okay, there you go. I like it. So for a lot of our audience, we have a lot of consumers on the podcast that listen in, as well as other professionals in the industry. But a lot of people don't know the National Association of Home Builders. So we're going to call it the NAHB going forward. So if you hear that, that's what that is. But could you tell the audience a little bit, what does NAHB really do?
We're the voice of home building in the country. Remember, home building represents about 16% of U.S. GDP. And that's not just people, you know, swinging hammers and building the homes. It's land development. It's the banks and the lumber yards. It's the associates who are part of the federation. It's remodeling. It's multifamily and as well as single family. So really, when it comes to building residential structures in the country, and even like commercial too, we are the voice for the industry. You know, here in Washington D.C., but also remember we're a federation of over 600 state and local associations as well. So collectively, you know, we represent, we're over 130,000 member firms. We represent somewhere about 6 or 7 million people in the industry. And for us, especially here in Washington, D.C., you know, NHB was created over 80 years ago by a group of local home builder associations who said, we need a voice in Washington, D.C. So one of our primary roles is advocacy. That make sure that we are advocating in the White House, in the regulatory agencies, and on Capitol Hill day in and day out to make sure that we build an economic and a regulatory and legislative climate and a judicial climate as well that allows us to build a house more affordably. Because at the end of the day, NHB has two missions. I call them the twin missions of NHB. First and foremost, is to make sure that we are providing affordable housing opportunity for all people. And then the second part of our mission is to make sure that we are providing professional success for our members. And if we can have successful businessmen and businesswomen in the home building industry, then they're going to be better prepared to build that affordable product. So, you know, we do that through a variety of ways. In addition to advocacy, we do a lot of networking, an ability for our members to get in touch with other members, to share ideas and become better people because of it. We do a lot of education. We transfer a lot of knowledge on how to build a home, how to run a business, what the industry is doing. We do a lot of things to cater to the industry, again, with all the sole purpose is to make sure that we are doing everything we can to build an affordable home or apartment for people. And we also have professional success as well.
No, that's great. I appreciate how you've explained it, because obviously there's a lot that NAHB does. I mean, especially being nationwide, you have a big footprint here. And we're going to talk a little bit more specifically about some of the issues in the building industry and housing affordability. But since you've kind of taken on the new role of going from chief lobbyist now to CEO, I guess first talk a little bit about how has the transition been, and then we'll kind of talk a little bit about kind of your vision and direction for it. But how was the transition, and how do you think it's going so far?
Yeah, I think it's going great. I made some changes at my senior management level to get a little smaller, a little more streamlined. You know, one of the things, David, and you know this, you've been in the NHB governance structure for years now. NHB's heavy. Our members drive our agenda. Our members are very active. You know, when it's advocacy or the direction of the industry, but with that comes with kind of a heavy governance structure, and sometimes NAHB can be very difficult I always equate turning a big ship.
Yeah,
right?
We call it the Titanic.
So yeah, right, the Titanic, and the rumor is the Titanic had a really small rudder. But for me, it's about getting us to think faster. You all, as businessmen and women, you have to react to market conditions, almost daily. And you're reacting to sales, you're reacting to building conditions, reacting to market prices. So I'd like to see us get faster as well, and really represent our industry as an association, as a business, reflective more of how our members have to operate. So that means, having a much more nimble structure. NHB, sometimes we will chew on issues for a while.
Yeah, we know.
we should be able to do things fast. We've got a lot of smart people in the room who run very, very successful businesses. We should be able to run NAHB as successfully as well. And so that's what I'm trying to do. Speed us up, but make sure we're giving everything all the due diligence that we do, but move faster. And so far, I think the transition has gone very, very well in really bringing that vision to the members, but as well as my team here in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree not only to get more nimble with NAHB, but also just with what you're doing, kind of not only with the staff and the team, it's been noticeable, and I appreciate it. And I think, it's just to say for those that aren't as involved with NAHB, you're the right guy for the job. You know the organization because you've been there, but you also know kind of some of the inherent challenges or issues that we've been facing over the years as an organization. And so, you have that unique perspective of being a part of it, but then now being able to kind of be in the driver's seat a little bit, right, and kind of shape it in your way. But I think what I also appreciate is the fact that you understand, from all the lobbying and everything, you understand this industry at its core and the challenges that we're facing. You also have the connections in DC. So, you're the right guy for the job. So,
thank you.
Glad that this happened, and I'm excited for some of the things that you're already doing. And so with that, one of the first objectives that you had as you've taken over this role is to come up with sort of a new strategic plan and vision for the organization. So why don't you kind of go over that? I know you've probably talked about that all last week, and you probably talked about it ad nauseum, but this would be great for all those that just don't get to hear this kind of information.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, this goes back to thinking faster, right? We had a strategic plan. We've had one for a while. It was due to expire at the end of 23. And with me coming in, I said, you know what? I'd like to revisit this strategic plan, not necessarily change it. If that's where the direction that the members wanted to go, great. But it was more just, it was an opportunity to kind of have a reset, especially with me as the new CEO. But I want to do it quickly, right? We would have taken a year to do a new strategic plan. We didn't need to do it. It's a 3-year plan, and so we should be able to do this quickly. And we did. We really moved our strategic plan within 6 months, and really engaged a broad swath of the membership, every corner of the membership. We surveyed over 3,000 of our members, We brought in a group of 30 people into Washington, D.C. for a really intensive two-day session. And then the board approved it at the end of last year. So there's five pillars, five goals. I call them pillars. And I think they really reflect of where the industry is. And I think, first and foremost, it's NHB as a federation. We talked about the NHB as a federation of over 600 state and local associations. We could look like, DC has a bad reputation. The Beltway has a bad reputation, out of touch. They don't do anything here. Since in NHB, that reflects on NHB that we just sit up here waiting for people to
call us. Local home builders associations, they don't realize like that, right? When you're a part of a local builder association, you're part of a national organization, and right, a lot of them just don't realize what NHB does.
That's right.
And I know you've been, the organization's been very cognizant about that, and having, not only you and some of the other staff, but also the senior leadership traveling around the country and just being at these events and saying, hey, we're here, we're listening, and we want to help. And I think that's amazing, right, that you guys are doing that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we have got to make sure that, you said, if you're a member of NHB or you want to be a member of NHB, you're going to join at the local home builder association level. And so we want to make sure that it's almost like the storefront for NHB, right? If you have a good experience there and you're getting the knowledge and the networking and the advocacy at the local level, that's where you're going to kick and feel and touch being a member of NHB. And so it's incumbent on NHB here to make sure that we are making our locals successful. So really leaning into the federation and making sure we're a partner with our state and local associations. And then number two is NHB, the members. How do we grow membership? I said we're about 140,000 member firms. We should be much more than that. We know that we do not have the whole sphere of home builders and associates and all the attendant parts of the industry under our tent. So we want to make sure that we are providing that value. David, just what you said, members want to know, what do we do here? Why do I want to be a member? What do my dues go for? We need to make sure that members understand that there's a lot of value in the dues that they're paying, and it will help their business. And then third is advocacy. I talked about that at the top of what we do. I think it's what we do among the best things that we do, but making sure that we continue to be an advocate for the industry. Again, that legislative, regulatory, and legal, as well as economic climate, making sure that is really, really good for the success of our members and success of the industry. Next would be public image. There's a lot of talk. People need to remember that, we build part of the American dream. I think we build the biggest part of the American dream. We keep people with safe, decent, affordable shelter over their heads every night. It's where their kids do homework around the table. It's where they have birthday parties and anniversary parties, and they grow up, and the memories are made. And we build that. Members of NHB build that. And that is important for the public to recognize that we are not only building the American dream, but we're the experts in the field, that lawmakers, regulatory agencies, every level of government need to recognize that we are the true experts. And I say this all the time. If we don't do it, somebody else will. I promise you, somebody else will do it for us. There are plenty of people, both people we count as friends and people we count as people working against affordability or ownership or rental. There are people that will gladly speak up for housing and home building, and I refuse to cede any ground to anybody else. We are the only association in the country that speaks for home building and absolutely, the creation of housing.
No, I appreciate the fact that, yeah, we're trying to get more public awareness out there for building, and it's not just all the positives of the family, but also what that does for the community when you have good home ownership and a good community, how that helps, the local municipality with their taxes, and it helps them, right, create a stable community and stable families, and helps with the education of the next generation and all those kind of things. So there's so many positives. And then I think the other thing you can add on to that, if you want a piece of advice, is we're also creating wealth for people when they buy a house. It's one of the best investments they're ever going to make in their lives. And we actually make people wealthy when they buy a home.
Yeah. Housing is the gateway to the middle class in America. It always has been. It's not going to be your 401k. While that is a relatively new version. I know my parents, their generation, the house was their retirement. When my parents left Connecticut and moved south, you know, that was their nest egg, was the equity they had built up in their house over 20 years or 30 years. And we have to remember that, right? And and David, you said it perfectly. Like that is how you become into the middle class. You build wealth. You know, how many people have put kids through college, taken care of an elderly parent, you know, even gone on vacations. You know, their house really is that nest egg that provides financial security. And so that is really, we have to just remind people of that day in and day out. And then the last pillar is workforce development. There is no single bigger issue facing the home building industry in the long term, other than the lack of skilled labor to build our homes and our apartments. Inflation will subside. Interest rates will also go lower over the next couple of years. Supply chains, you know, while some are still creaky, they will resolve themselves as well. But the persistent drag on our industry and the ability to build affordably is the lack of labor. You know this better than anybody. It's we're not replacing the aging skilled laborers in our workforce with new kids. Yes, some are coming on, but you know, most people are apt to tell their kids you're only going to be successful in this country if you go get a 4-year college degree. And we have got to change the mindset of parents and kids to remind them that the trades are not plan B if you can't make it in college, that they are plan A. And anybody who's had any work done on a home or in the last 5 or 6 years, you know full well that those skilled craftsmen and women are making a good buck, and they have great careers and they're very happy people. So that's the five pillars, but that workforce one is really important.
Yeah, I'm glad that was added into the plan. And I would agree with you 100%, especially it's important to include the workforce development. You know, we haven't even replaced the last housing recession, the amount of people we lost in the industry because of that. You know, we lost half our workforce. And, you know, it's already been challenging to get kids into the workforce because that's what they're told all the way through grade school, all the way to high school is go to college. That's success, which that's not the only way you can have success, as you mentioned, right? It's the trades. You can start a trade. You have a skill for life. You can now run a company in a couple of years and you can make a really, really great living off of it. No debt. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why you'd want to do it. And, you know, quite frankly, there's some people that are just not meant to be in in school. They don't like school. They like working with their hands. They like creating and making things. They like the pride of I built this, I made this. If you any of that stuff touches you, you should think about getting the trades. You know, if that gets you interested, it gets you jacked up. That's, you know, those are the kind of people we need.
Right.
And
That's exactly right.
Well, I love the 5 points. Summarize those, it's NHB as a federation and how it relates with the locals. It's serving the members. It's advocacy in the housing industry. We're going to dive into that some more. Obviously, public image of housing and making sure that that's first and foremost in the media. And then, of course, developing our workforce. I think those are all 5 really worthy things that we should be working on as an industry and continuing to help, you know, not only grow the industry, but also keep the American dream alive for everybody. So you didn't say this, but I'm going to give you the opportunity now. What is the vision of NEHB?
Yeah, so this goes right along with our mission, but NEHB's vision is building homes, enriching communities, and changing lives. And that says it all. That's what we do. It's much like what you mentioned. We were working through talking about the strategic goals. It is about that what a home and an apartment means for people and families, and that's that enriching lives piece at the end. So it's good.
No, I think it's inspiring, and I think that it's succinct and it tells people exactly what we do.
That's right.
At the organization, and it's great that's becoming more focal and in the front of everything that we're doing, because I think, you know, over the years, you know, like we mentioned with NHB being kind of slower to react, I think we kind of lost our vision a little bit, lost our way, started worrying about too much about this meeting and this group and this guy's voting rights and everything else. And, you know, really at the core of what we got to do is we are in a battle for housing right now.
Yep.
We are in a battle for housing affordability. We are in a battle for protecting the American dream for the next generation and fighting for that so that they have the same opportunity that we have. And so I'm glad to see that we're kind of getting back on mission here. And I think in the next few years, we're going to see a lot of hopefully positive changes in that direction and continue to move forward with that. All right.
Yeah,
so let's talk a little bit more about housing affordability, because that's obviously, I think, top of mind for everybody in the industry. It's out of control. What are your thoughts on it? And where do we go from here to start tackling getting not affordable housing, but housing affordability where everyone can afford housing?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, in my mind, the fundamental answer is we need more supply. That's really what it is. We have just got to put more units in the marketplace and use the old laws of supply and demand, that if we put enough supply on there to meet demand, that prices will fall naturally. That of course is going to be a challenge. There's still a lot of demand out there for a home. It's been suppressed by high interest rates, but we expect those rates to begin to fall over the course of this year. And so more people will come on the marketplace or into the marketplace. But we need local governments in particular to make free up more land, move land development and home construction more quickly through the process, just so we can meet that demand. And I know the members are ready to do that. It's all about putting more units in the ground and getting people more opportunities to buy. Like I said earlier, you know, interest rates will subside. That's obviously the big driver right now of cost. You know, building materials, well, if you know, when demand comes back fully back is over the next several years, we could see a spike in building materials. I still think it's just the ability to build more houses and try to build them as affordably as we can.
No, I agree. I think supply is a huge issue because obviously that's what we're seeing out in the real estate market is there just isn't enough homes out there. The challenge that we're facing is that unfortunately a lot of the new construction homes out there are just so much more than the existing stock of homes out there. And so, you know, we have like kind of the younger buyer out there, the millennials, they're just not able to afford, you know, that new construction home. And so it's a complicated issue, right? Because we are dealing with local and state issues as well. So sometimes it's just taking too long to get the house approved on the market, or taking too long to get a subdivision, or there's just too many, I'd like to say, cooks in the kitchen with the government, yeah, right?
That's right.
So is there anything that we can do either from an industry or from NEHB to help with that part of it? Because that seems to be, whether it's the lengthy permit times or the lengthy subdivision approval times, or just even the cost of everything, what can we do there to get more awareness? Because I think some of the municipalities just don't realize like they're the ones that are the problem sometimes.
Right. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, what I tell people, and so it's something for your listeners, about 24% of the cost of a single family home is embedded in regulations at all three levels of government. For a multifamily unit, it's almost 43%. So regulation really is not, we're not saying we want to do away with regulations. That's not what we talk about. But to your point about there's so many stops along the pipeline when it comes to planning a project, lowering those times, you know, you don't cross a T. So somebody rejects the rejects the permit. You have to go back to the drawing board and add more time. And all of that just continues to add to the cost, right? You know, builder, it has to have the carrying costs on the land. And before you can kind of realize, you know, the selling or the renting of the unit, that really is what really adds cost to it. So what I'd like to tell all lawmakers is you find ways to lower the regulatory burdens, and you will then lower the regulatory costs, and therefore the ultimate end buyer or renter is going to see a reduction in it. That's all. Move things through the process. You know, I know
absolutely.
Everybody
it's
wants
kind of like
slice.
The easy button at Staples or the
yeah,
Amazon.
That's right.
You know,
just
one click, right? Yeah, you know.
Yeah, and look, I get it. Everybody, every lawmaker, bureaucrat wants their taste to make sure that, you know, they're all important in the process. But there's got to be a way to make it easier, whether it's by right development, which for, you know, is, you know, if you check all the boxes that the municipality wants you to check, if you check them all, you're good to go. Just go by right, go develop it. Now you want to make some changes and do something differently. Sure. That's going to take a little bit more time. But we need, you know, here's what I would say. Lawmakers at all levels of government, they need to embrace housing as an economic driver. You talked about it earlier, whether it's taxes, whether it's school districts, all the things all the good things that housing provides. But it also brings jobs. It allows nurses and firefighters and police women and police men to stay in the communities that they serve. It allows kids to stay in the communities they grew up in if they choose to, right? You know, how many times I've got to move out of my hometown because I can't afford to live here. I want to live next to mom and dad.
That's a shame, and that's something we gotta put an end to. And I think one of the things too is that we have a lot of history, and sometimes it doesn't always serve us well. In that, you know, we're doing a lot of things from those standards way back in after World War II,
yep.
Right? 1950s, we had to get housing built, so we created all these standards. And some of those things, we just can't seem to move away from it because that's the way we've always done it.
Right.
And so like the minimums that we have for the lot sizes or the minimums that we have for the houses and the, you know, how far apart they are and all these kind of things, those are directly contributing to the cost of, you know, developing these homes. We're not building on flat farm fields next to schools and churches anymore.
Right.
Those are built, right? Yep. Now we're building on rolling land and different terrain, and we're applying these same kind of antiquated rules and standards. And so I think we have to kind of like take a step back almost and revisit what some of these things are and what really housing looks like. And I know there's like a lot of stuff happening now, like tiny home movement and stuff like that, but it's like most of the time you can't even do those because the rules aren't in place for anything like that.
Yeah. It's to your point. I don't think we've kept up with innovation in housing, and we can have a conversation about what innovation housing looks like, but just like you said, just land use needs to be done differently. You know, and you know, the other thing you all face is NIMBYs. And that's for everybody that's not in my backyard. People.
Oh yeah.
People
we've talked about it on the show before, if you've listened, but I appreciate you bringing it back up.
Yeah. I mean, it's people who already have theirs and don't want anybody to got theirs or get theirs. And that's really unfortunate because all it does, and lawmakers tend to kowtow to those people because that's their votes, right? People
who live in the vocal minority. Voting.
You know, you're talking about, you know, people who haven't moved into the community that they're not voters yet. And it would be great if more local government officials stood up to NIMBYs and said, no, we are going to build more housing. It's good for the community and really put housing first. That's the main thing. Put housing first ahead of everything else. It's about time people stood up for housing rather than, you know, everything else that seems to put housing on its back heel. So,
yeah, no, I agree. I think we've shown that like housing just makes, you know, not only better property values, but safer communities, all those kind of things. It doesn't really cause the problems like people say, right? That you get the environmental groups and things that are saying, hey, you know, you're using this land and you're scaring away this and you're creating drainage problems, all these kind of things. But look at what it fixes. It adds safety and it adds value and it adds good families and jobs. And
yep,
it does a lot more good than it does bad.
Exactly. Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yep.
So speaking of legislatively, what are a few things that NHB is working on right now as far as issues in DC?
Yeah. So we're working on a tax bill that carries for anybody on the who's listening, who does low income housing tax credit developments or multifamily. There's a tax bill that's moving through. It's got some really good stuff in it. More tax credits so we can build more affordable rental. Some new changes to the depreciation tables that allow people to expense things and depreciate things faster. So there's a tax bill. It's working its way. It's already passed the House. It's trying to get it through the Senate. But that would be a really important piece for housing. We're also keeping an eye on just the appropriations process. It's been broken all year and going even back into last year. So there's a lot of stuff we rely on, government programs that our members use. The flood insurance program is tied to this. So moving that along to make sure that we don't see any lapse in the national flood insurance program and coverage there or the ability to even to write new policies. And we're also tracking some energy legislation, and we are trying to lower the cost of complying with some of the new efforts to get to net zero or gas bans.
Yeah, and some of that stuff I think is some of the biggest threats and some of the scariest stuff out there, because we're a nation that runs on gas.
Yep.
And gas heating and everything for home. So you take that away and boy, you've got a lot of cost and a lot of pain if we can't use gas to heat our houses.
That's right. Yeah. So we're trying and people write, you know, look, we build the most energy efficient and most resilient home in the country today. It's more efficient and more resilient than the homes we built last year. And next year's homes are going to be more efficient and more resilient than this year. But there is this real, it's kind of forcing everything to get more efficient and get tighter and get, again, get to net zero piece, but with little regard, if any regard for what the cost is to that house. You know, I'm tired of hearing, hey, we're going to save people $15 a month on their energy bills. Isn't that great? Yeah, but that house is going to cost $15,000 more. This goes back to your point about new construction, David. That the people who need housing, you know, those first time or first generational buyers, that move up buyer, they need to be, new construction needs to be an option for them. And with all of these increases in costs, it's not an option for them. And I think energy efficiency, again, while our members support more energy efficiency, but we support doing it where it's also affordable for the consumer.
We're looking for reasonable paybacks and, you know, you hit it on the head. I mean, if you said everybody's got to put solar in, well, that's going to take out even more first-time buyers. They're not going to be able to afford to put solar on a home. And, you know, the payback just isn't there yet. You know, I mean, when you're at 20, 25 years, most people don't live in their homes that long, especially if it's your first home. And so I think that's one of the challenges that we always face, is that a lot of these burdens get thrown on new construction. And, you know, what's going to waste more energy, a brand new home that's built with these new standards, or a home that was built 50 years ago where you got the furnace on and the air is leaking out of all the windows and the holes in the wall and through the outlets and everything else. And so, you know, unfortunately, new construction takes a heavier load of that burden.
We'll build, you know, 900 to 1 million units this year, single family units this year, nationwide. That's a drop in the bucket to the amount of homes that are out there. In fact, there's over 130 million homes that were built before 2000. We kind of use that as that's when we would call modern codes came in after that. If you care about energy efficiency in the built environment, it's just exactly what you said, David. Older homes are where the energy savings are most acute, and that's where we need to focus our energy.
Absolutely. And that's where it makes sense maybe putting a new furnace in or doing some energy updates.
That's right.
You're going to get a lot more bang for the buck, basically. I think that's where we got to kind of shift the dialogue, hopefully.
Right.
Okay. So kind of shifting gears a little bit, just about the housing industry and the housing market. Obviously, we were through a pretty rough environment last year with super high interest rates. They've come down a little bit. Hopefully, have some stuff coming forward. What's your kind of outlook in the next year or two for housing?
I think we're getting ready to really start to take off. So 2024 is what I've been calling the pivot year. This is the one where we've already seen interest rates kind of retreat from their highs, close to 8%. Mortgage rates are now coming down. They're in the sixes, kind of hovering right around that seven. I think they will continue to fall through the course of the year. We actually are predicting that by the time we get to the end of 2024, that mortgage rates will be in this, you know, still above six, but, you know, between 6 and 6.5%. We've already seen that start to even now start to unlock some of that pent up demand, people starting to enter into the market. And then when we get into 2025, I think that's when we finally see mortgage rates settle into what I believe is going to be the new normal. And that's right around 5 to 5.5%. And of course, builders who you know, are able to help buyers you know, buy down rates, you know, could even start creeping into, you know, even now they're creeping into the fives, might even creep into the fours. The days of a 3% or 4% mortgage are gone. At least that's my prediction. And we've got to get people recognizing there's a new normal out there. And that's a 5%, which, you know, for people who have been in the industry a long time, that is dirt cheap money for an investment like you have in your home. But with that, I think demand starts to come back, and I really think that we're going to get back to pace of building, you know, 1.5, 1.6 million units a year. I mean, that's multifamily and single family as well. But I'm really bullish on the next 5 years. Just the demographics are great. The millennials are the biggest generational cohort we've had in a while. They are moving into their prime home building. year. So I just think that the industry is ready to really take off.
No, I agree. Yeah, you've got buyer demographics that are looking good. You've got rates coming down. We still have strong demand, even though the rates were high. So that doesn't look like that's going to change at all. And you've got properties growing in value. So people that have homes already have been making a ton of money on them. They're building equity. Okay. They're building that wealth that we talked about. And it'll be an opportunity for them to potentially sell it and upgrade or change into something more appropriate for wherever they're at their life. So
yeah,
it's shaping up to be good. So that means if you're a buyer out there, it's a good time to buy before the prices go up and the competition goes up too.
That's right. Agreed.
All right. So you're kind of starting on predictions a little bit. And since you're a lobbyist at heart, political junkie at heart, yep. We got to talk about the looming 2024 election. So why don't you give us brief predictions? What do you think is going to happen in House, Senate, and the president?
Yeah, so House and Senate both have super tight majorities. Only really the Republicans only have a two vote majority in the House. The Democrats have a one vote majority in the Senate. The way I see it right now, and obviously there's a long way to travel before we get to November, but I think we're going to see the majorities flip. I think there's a high likelihood that the Republicans lose the House, and that will flip back over to the Democrats. And that's based on some of the seats that are going to be highly contested. Republicans won a high number of open seats or competitive seats in New York and in California in particular. I could see that starting to reverse a little bit, and some of those more traditional Democrat seats swing back to the Democratic Party. Now, gains in North Carolina or Texas or Florida for Republicans could counterbalance that. But given the really slim majority in the House, I just see a scenario where I think the House flips to the Democratic control. Not a wave, but certainly enough to handle.
It's just the Democrat or the demographics are there that show that, you know, you have so many, like one party has so many seats open.
Yep.
So there's just more chance that some of them are going to flip the other way. Yep, correct.
That's right.
Yep. Yeah. And especially in stronghold areas, they're going to flip.
Exactly. And in the same, which you just talked about, the same holds for the Senate. There are more Democratic seats in red states that are up for re-election or up for election this year. That's why I see the Senate flipping. You know, like I said, there's a one seat majority in the Senate now. Joe Manchin, who has decided not to run in West Virginia. West Virginia has gotten deeply red. You know, that's in my mind is already a flip. That one is so. Now we're at the moment we're looking at a 50-50 Senate if nothing else changes, but Ohio, Montana, Arizona, there are even, you know, Pennsylvania to a certain extent.
And I know Kristen Sinema is not running now too.
That's right. She decided she's not going to run. So there are just really good pickup opportunities for Republicans in this cycle. And that's why I see a scenario where the Republicans could flip the Senate and take a one or two seat majority in the Senate going in next year, which means divided government, which means whoever the president is a year from now, will not be able to jam through their legislative agenda. They'll have to compromise if anything's going to get done, which then leads to the kind of the final prediction. And this is the one I try to stay away from the most. Donald Trump is now the presumptive nominee. He'll, you know, a couple more primary dates coming up that he will have the majority of the votes,
lock it in.
Which means the election cycle starts early, right? Rather than starting in June or July.
Gear up for your commercials and won't be able to watch any kind of programming on TV without getting hit with
especially in a swing state like Wisconsin, you're gonna be inundated. So I think we see Trump is trending in all the polls. That's great for at least momentum, but in general, we're still a long way away. The president's State of the Union is coming up this week. We'll see how he does there. Of course, the president is facing a lot of questions about his age, about his agenda. And what I would just leave your listeners with, and this was something I did an interview with Chuck Todd during the International Builder Show last week. And he said, people asked, is Trump really going to win? I said, yeah. And he said, give him all the credit for this. You have to ask yourself, how is Trump running? Is Trump running as the challenger to Joe Biden, or is Trump running as an incumbent as former President Trump? And in they're two different metrics.
That's very interesting.
As a challenger, Trump is doing very well. But if you ask yourself, is Trump is an incumbent? His numbers are not very good. Much like Joe Biden's numbers are not very good for an incumbent. So that is going to have to unwind itself as we get through the next.
I think that's really astute observation. Yeah. And, you know, I think given the situation that we're in, you don't normally have already sitting president running again as a challenger.
Yeah.
So it's a very weird situation. But at the same time, I think the guy that paints the best vision for the next 4 years and what they're going to do and what they're going to accomplish and what they want, I think that's going to resonate more with people, I would think, rather than getting down and dirty and getting into fist fight with each other. I don't know that that's going to benefit either of them at this point, because they both don't have, let's be honest, they both don't have high favorability ratings. They're well-known and well-accomplished folks, but not necessarily the most well-liked people in the world.
Right. Exactly.
So it's interesting. And I think it'll also matter on who they can reach as far as the independents and, get them to sway one direction or another. It's gonna be a close election either way. So hopefully,
either way. Yep.
Hopefully we're not into a 10 days of waiting and figuring this out. But
I hope not.
That's probably the worst outcome of all when we have those situations.
Right.
So
that's right.
Okay. So what's keeping you up at night besides all these other things we talked about?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. We could have pretty much covered the waterfront. Yeah. I think what keeps me up at night is keeping the momentum going of my first 9 months here. I think that's really what it is. It's just all the things that I want to lean into is keeping that momentum going. That's really what it is. And staying in front of the members, and again, reminding NHB that we're a partner with our Federation partners. I think that's it. I think membership, trying to grow the membership and making sure that people recognize the value of NHB. And then finally, I think maybe the biggest one is if our vision for where the industry is headed over these next 5 years, making sure that we do everything we can to make that a reality, meaning getting that legislative and that regulatory and that economic environment humming in the right direction so that you all can go build all those homes, getting local governments to embrace housing, lowering those costs and those barriers to entry for those first-time home buyers. And that's what keeps me up, is can we deliver on the promise of being that economic engine and really delivering an affordable home for people over the next 5 years?
I agree. That's fantastic. Anything else you'd like to add or share with the audience?
David, I just want to say, personally, I saw you in Wisconsin last month. And of course, we had a chance to at least pass each other the hallway and visit for a little bit when we were at IBS. But I just want to thank you for everything you do. I want to give a shout out to your book, Leadership Growth Hacks. I've read it. It's funny. I try to keep reading and just take little snippets of things. But I really enjoyed your book. I can see a lot of things that I've been trying to do resonated with me in your book, and just reinforced what I think. And also, I got to be honest with you, there's areas like I need to do that more. Right.
There you go. Good.
Yeah. There's really some things in there that I thought were great. So I'll put a shameless plug in for your book.
I appreciate that. We have a link in the episode about that if you want to pick it up. But it was neat seeing, like, as you're going through the planning process, and I had a whole section on vision, mission, and culture. And seeing, like, actually you had the triangle even, like, in my book, and I was like, oh, this is so cool. And that's seeing NHB do that, it's just really awesome, because that really helps, especially when you have a large member organization like this. When you have a very clear vision and direction for the organization, it's a lot easier to get behind it and get people to buy into it. And so it made a big impact on my business, and hopefully it make a big impact on NHB. And I'm glad that you found value in it, and I appreciate that you enjoyed it. And we'll post a picture. We got a picture of us together with the book.
We do.
From Vegas. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
And I'm glad it was helpful to you. So
appreciate it.
I just want to say thank you, Jim, for your time. I know you're a busy guy. Appreciate you coming on and sharing as much as you did, and appreciate your leadership and the organization. And thank you for coming on today.
Yeah. Thanks, David. I appreciate it. It was great to visit with you.
All right. Sounds great. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks.
Once again, thank you for tuning in to the Home Building Hero, broadcasting live from the Bellman Home Studio. If you haven't already, please make sure to give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts,
and make sure to hit that subscribe button so you don't miss any future content. Until next time, I'm David Bellman, signing off.